My name is Paul Tippins. I'm 70 years old. Today is the 14th of March, 2018, and I'm speaking with Orlando. He's my neighbor. And we're recording this in Chico, California.
Tell me what it was like as a child. How do you like to spend your, how did you like to spend your time?
I grew up in a little place called Galena Park, Texas, which was a part of Houston, Texas, which is the largest city in the South. But we had our own little community, and there were probably, I would guess about 400 homes in this little community. It was made like a circle with a number of streets running down the middle of it, kind of honeycombed. So all the kids, everybody all went to the same school. The neighborhood had its own school, so everybody knew everybody. And I did the cell papers from probably the fourth grade. I delivered all of the sales papers for the grocery stores and the department stores.
Were you walking
stores,
or were you like in a bike or how was that?
I walked because the cell papers were too big.
That was just too much
for the bike. So I had to walk and carry them. And I did that two times a week.
How much was the pay for that?
I don't remember, but it couldn't have been very much.
Like a couple quarters.
Couldn't have been very much because cookies were two for a penny.
Two cookies for a penny?
Two cookies for a penny. Oh, big cookies. Jesus. But I only did that 2 days a week. And in the summer, we would take off our shoes after the last day of school. And we didn't wear shoes again unless we were going to church or going somewhere.
Oh, a special event or
but
something.
Playing in the summer, or all the time that we spent in the summer was done without shoes. And we rode bikes and everything with no shoes. So everybody in the neighborhood would play in the street. We would have football games until the street lights came on. When the street lights came on, that's a cliche now. People say, want you home, but when the street lights come home. But when the street lights came on, that's when everybody went home. And sometimes that would be 8:30, 9 o'clock at night.
What time is it?
And nobody worried about it. I would leave home in the morning, get my bike right after breakfast, and they wouldn't see me back at home until dinner. And usually I was late for dinner.
How would they find you? Like, let's say they were like,
they didn't find me. I came home.
Oh, you just came home?
I came home.
Like, oh, where's Paul?
Because the street light came on, and that was like the alarm.
Okay, so what if, like, let's say in the situation where you didn't come home when the street lights, you know, once they went on,
I wouldn't risk that because I might not be allowed to leave the next day.
Okay,
So I was pretty consistent, pretty self-managed. I came home. I came home because I knew I didn't want to have any restrictions going forward from there, because that was my whole life, socializing with these people and playing with these kids. And nobody smoked. I never met a kid that smoked, and well, I'll tell you about that later. Anyway, during that time period, my elementary school, nobody smoked, nobody cursed, there were no fights. Nobody got hurt. Nobody got injured. It was just
more peaceful.
It was peaceful, yeah. It was
compared to now.
Kind of like the old TV show, Leave It to Beaver.
I don't think I've ever watched it.
Yeah, well, Leave It to Beaver, there was a perfect community, and everybody was happy, and it was real. That's where I grew up, in a community exactly like Leave It to Beaver.
Why do you think it was so peaceful? Was it?
It was peaceful because everybody knew everybody. If I did something bad a mile from my house, those people would come and tell my parents. And everybody knew that. Everybody knew that because all the parents knew each other because all the kids went to the same school. So you just didn't do those kinds of things. And we didn't have any bad influences there bringing it in, which was odd because, like I said, it was like 400 homes, so that's 400, about 400 families there, and there just wasn't any problems.
You must assume there must have been at least some problem here and there, right?
Just sitting here now thinking about it, I can't remember ever seeing a police car in my neighborhood.
What about the other surrounding neighborhoods? Like,
I don't know.
That's all you knew.
All I knew was that place. All I knew was that area, you know, and everything was there. Stores, the ice cream truck would come through once a week.
That's something we don't have anymore around here.
And the bug man would come through, and they would spray DDT or something. It's a miracle I'm alive, because what we used to do, there would be 50 bicycles riding in the fog. When this truck was coming and spraying, they were spraying for mosquitoes.
And you guys went through the fog.
We rode in it. Oh, man. Rode right in the fog, following the truck. They were spraying for mosquitoes. But
and those chemicals, I'm sure they're a lot more harmful.
Yeah, they were pretty bad. I'm sure.
Really tough stuff.
I'm sure they were pretty bad. If I drop dead today, I'll know why.
Recall back to that in the bike through it. And. Well, tell me about your high school experience.
Well, in 1959, we moved from the Leave It to Beaver community in Texas to San Francisco. Supposedly a greater opportunity for my father's employment, and which was going to trickle down to us, which was going to be a great move for us. I hated it with every ounce of energy I had in my body, because I was leaving everything I'd known and all my friends. And we came to California. It was April of 1959. And my first day at school, this was the sixth grade. I went to school and I saw things that I had never even imagined possible. Things I had never seen on TV, things I just never imagined it. I saw the first day in class, I saw a kid curse the teacher out. I mean, just literally curse the teacher out. I saw two or three fights. I got picked on. It was really something else. And the school was integrated. Well, up to then, the school that I went to was all segregated. So these schools were integrated, and it was culture shock for me on every plane that you could possibly imagine. Every bit of it was culture shock. I wasn't allowed to go out and spend my days roaming around like I did before. Everything was strictly controlled, and there was a lot of stress because I could feel how insecure my parents were about me being out where I was. So we're there in San Francisco, and within a month, I was with my cousin who had grown up there. And he took me to some places that my parents would have just died if they knew I had gone to. But one day we were up on Fillmore Street in San Francisco, and at that time, we were in front of Wesley Johnson's Pharmacy, which was a really big deal in San Francisco back in those days. And this was all 1959. And the streets are shoulder to shoulder. And all of a sudden, there's this screaming and yelling. And he and I are standing next to this scale. There was a giant scale on the street. You put a penny in, stand on it, and it would give you your weight and a fortune. So we're standing there next to the scale, and this crowded street starts to part. People start stepping aside. And this lady comes running through, and a guy is chasing her. She comes over to the scale a few feet from us, grabs the corner of the scale like she's trying to hide behind the scale, and there was no way to get behind the scale, just as this guy caught up with her, and he stabbed her. I'm 12 years old. I'm 12 years old, and I'm witnessing this coming from where I came from. So that was pretty severe culture shock.
So yeah, it just changed your whole outlook on
that,
life.
That, I believe that changed my whole life. I believe that day changed that my day whole life. And there's a song, and when that song comes on, it always makes me remember that day.
About that day.
And I don't know what happened to that lady. I don't know how bad she was hurt, because everybody started running and leaving. And my cousin got me out of there, because the last thing in the world he wanted was for it to be so traumatic for me that I went home and told what I saw.
What happened.
So I never, ever told my parents what I saw. They never knew. Because they would have prevented, they would not have allowed me to go with him ever again.
Yeah, I mean, as a parent, you can only imagine, like, oh, where else are they going to go after that? You know
well,
I mean?
Yeah, it's just only going to get worse.
And
next
no,
one,
no one helped.
To be,
no one helped her out or tried.
Nobody
to
stopped
stop
the guy.
Anything,
I did not see anybody do anything to help that lady. I got out of there with my cousin. She was crumbled down on the ground next to that scale. That's the last thing I remember seeing, and I'm not sure where he was at that time. But I do know that nobody interfered with him. Nobody.
What do you think that was? Like,
people, there were a lot of people and they were all in close proximity of each other, but they were all very distant to each other. They didn't have anything that connected them other than their location. You know, they happened to all be there, but they didn't care. They didn't know each other.
Because you think, like, if something like this was to happen nowadays, like, somebody would have at least tried to do something about it, or what do you think?
I think maybe there might have been one or two people that might have stepped up. There still wouldn't ever be a lot. Oh, I still don't feel that. So. But had this same thing happened back in Galena Park in Texas, the guy might not have made it out of there alive because the people would have torn him apart. He probably wouldn't have been able to stab this lady because somebody would have prevented him from getting to her. They wouldn't have just parted and let him get to her. Happen. That would not have happened in Galena Park. That happened in San Francisco. It was a whole different environment. So from there, I finished elementary school in San Francisco. I went to junior high school in San Francisco, and I went to high school in San Francisco.
And did you live, like, on San Francisco itself, or, like, on
the house? No, I lived
in San Francisco.
The hard parts of San Francisco. What I found out after I got to San Francisco, I found out what the definition of poor was. Because before I moved to San Francisco, I never realized that I had grown up poor all my life. I had no knowledge of that. Because in San Francisco, I saw people that weren't poor every day. And I saw how they lived, and I saw what they had, and I didn't see those things in Galena Park. I didn't see those things in Texas. Everybody there was pretty much on the same plane. Everybody's house was built at the same time. So they were all new houses. Everybody's income seemed to all be about the same. And see, from what I know today, I know why that was, but I didn't understand that then. Now I understand those homes were built and financed under the VA. They were GI homes, ex-military people. They sold those homes to, and they all
everybody
had...
Everybody there was like veterans and stuff?
Well, they were all veterans. And okay. It was low interest financing, so low-income people were able to get in there. And so everybody was at the same economic level. Because that was what qualified you to buy those houses. And so everybody, we moved into a model, one of the models. The day we moved in, we took down the flags. You know, they had ropes with flags that flapped in the wind and the breeze. And I can remember laying in my bedroom and still hearing those flapping going from those houses because they were all brand new. So, and I didn't realize until San Francisco that the whole time we were there, I was poor. We were poor, and I had no knowledge of that. So that information was also part of my culture shock in San Francisco, which carried on through high school. When I got to junior high school in San Francisco, we lived in the projects, because when we first came, we stayed with my aunt, but there were seven kids.
You guys all lived in one home, pretty much?
We lived in one home, my parents, and seven kids. So we were really crowded. We were really crowded. And so things didn't pan out for my father the way that he thought they would. He was an educated man, had a college degree, and couldn't find a job. He had a hard time getting a job. The first job he got was cleaning airplanes
What was the job he was looking that they kind of, I guess, not promised, but, you know, like, told him about?
Well, his brother had already moved to San Francisco, and my uncle, and he had a great job working for the government out at the military base in San Francisco. So he just told my dad, I'll help you until you find a job. And they did. They did do that. We had a lot of family support. You know, we had a lot of kids, so we had a lot of family support to carry us. But my mother was going stir crazy because she needed her own place. So the first place we qualified for was the projects. Well, we didn't know anything about any projects. My parents didn't know anything about projects. So we go.
That was in San Francisco,
In San Francisco. Okay. We moved to Hunters Point projects in San Francisco. And what they didn't realize was that for a kid my age, I'm junior high school age, that was like taking me and dropping me in the middle of a war zone. And that's exactly what happened. I got dropped in the middle of a war zone that I was not prepared for. I hadn't been raised like these kids. I didn't know the things that they knew. So my survival skills were not there, not for them. And that place, that junior high school that I went to, they had what they call rat packs. That's what we called them back then. It'd be like 10 or 15 kids. And they would just walk around, find one kid, and just beat him down, stomp him, kick him.
Just for no reason?
Just like... no reason. So we lived in terror. I tried like crazy to eat in the cafeteria. If you brought your lunch, you were not allowed to eat in the cafeteria. You had to eat in the yard. If you ate in the yard, then these gangs were there.
So they'd come to you.
They would come to you. So I got a paper route in junior high school, and I started delivering newspapers so that I could go to the cafeteria. A lot of days I couldn't afford the whole lunch, but if I went in there and I bought a carton of milk and a cinnamon roll or something like that, I could sit in the cafeteria to eat that. So that became my lunch. Milk and a cinnamon roll, because that's all I could afford, even with the paper route. So, we had to ride the bus home from school. The bus had to circle around, go through Hunters Point, but to get, Hunters Point was a giant hill out by Candlestick Park in San Francisco. And the whole area is like 5 or 6 square miles of nothing but projects with a lot of streets. Well, to get to my street, I had to ride through some neighborhoods that were a little less than desirable, you might want to say. So what we used to do, the bus would go through there. Everybody, it'd be like 8 or 9 kids left on the bus when we came around the hill up at Hunters Point. We would get under the seat because the kids in Hunters Point would stand on the hill and throw rocks
at the bus,
crashing through the windows. One day we got stuck up there because the driver got injured, got cut on the side of his face for a broken glass from rocks that came through the windows.
And they didn't try to, no one like, didn't have police or anything, like try to stop them or anything?
Before we moved out of Hunters Point, they got their own police. I guess now you would call it a precinct.
And for that little area.
But just for that area. So San Francisco PD put a building up there, and they had patrol cars that patrolled the area. Did not stop the buses from getting rocked. It did not. It just absolutely did not. And my parents were so frustrated, they didn't know what to do. They didn't know how to protect us. They didn't know how to save us. So I lived there up until high school. And I started high school, and I spent a year in high school in San Francisco. And my parents came up with this brilliant idea to buy a house, because my father now was working for United Airlines. He had gone from washing airplanes to being a scheduler. So now he's scheduling out at United Airlines and making decent money. So they decided they were going to buy a house, and they wanted out of San Francisco. So they went to Oakland.
Oakland.
They went across the bridge to Oakland and bought a house in East Oakland. Brookfield Village in East Oakland, and they thought that was the answer to all of my problems. And it was exactly the opposite.
Was it way worse than San Francisco?
I think so. It was more violent. It was more drug infested. It was really bad. East Oakland, Brookfield was really, really, really bad. But by now,
you're in high school, right?
I'm in high school now. By now, I'm changing. So I'm just like anybody, you know, if you drop a man in the middle of the jungle and you don't give him any tools to work with, and he has to develop tools and survival skills based on what it takes to do that, that's what happened to me. So I got there, I started smoking marijuana with the kids, I started drinking, I started smoking cigarettes, because I needed to survive. Yeah, I needed to
fit in with.
Yeah, I had to fit in. I could not be the victim. I learned that if you fit in, that you weren't the victim. So a lot of the friends that I had, the guys that I had, were tough guys. I mean, the kind of people you don't want to mess with. And so I had this protective cloak, and this protective cloak was these guys, these people. So in the classroom, and all of this reflected back to the classroom, because in my earlier years in San Francisco, teacher would ask a question. My education was 2 years ahead of the kids that I was in class with in San Francisco, the education I brought from Texas. So that put a lot of burden on me, because the teacher would ask a question, my hand would just automatically fly up because I already knew the answer.
Did that get you a lot of attention?
That gave me all the wrong attention. Yeah. Because the kids totally resented that. They totally resented me because I knew the answer. So by the time I got to Oakland in high school, teacher asked a question, I know the answer. Yeah, I know. I'm not going to tell them. I'm not going to tell anybody I know. So I started doing bad, and I barely got out of high school. When I left Texas, and I didn't mention this part, I was a straight A student from the first through the sixth grade. Straight A's.
Impressive, straight A's.
Straight A's. Nothing less than straight A's. I won spelling bees. I went to Austin. I went to Dallas for spelling bee competitions that the school paid for and took me on. And I wrote essays that got recognition. I wrote an essay on smoking cigarettes. I can't remember all of the content of it, but I do remember me working on the project, and I do remember being awarded for writing that essay and making a poster to go with it. But San Francisco started the downtrend, where I started, in order to protect myself, not giving the answers. And then by the time I got to high school, I had to be petitioned to get out of high school. I had to petition teachers and classes to get them to say that I actually deserved to graduate when I actually hadn't qualified.
You had to convince them,
Yes, to let me go, to let me graduate, even though I hadn't actually earned it. And so all my dreams of going to college, all of that, went down the tube, starting with San Francisco, where I had to begin to transition who I was to survive with the people because of who they were.
And I guess, so because of that, would you say that that's why you, did you look to enlist in the Army, or did they draft you? That's the, I guess, the big
question. Well, what happened was, because I wasn't going to college, in 1966, I'm in high school. And if you're not going into college, the draft board, which was extremely active in 1968, would classify you as 1A. 1A meant you're at the top of the list. When the next group of people are drafted, you're 1A, you're in that group. Whether they get to your name for that month or the next month or the next month, they were drafting 1As. So I was classified as a 1A before I graduated from high school, because there was no chance that I could get into college because of my turmoils of high school and latter years of junior high school. So the only other alternative was to work for the government. If you get a job working for the government, then you were deferred. That would change your classification from a 1A to something less draftable. So the only thing available was to work for the post office. And in Oakland, there was a giant post office hub. I mean, did it stop?
Oh, no, I was just saying.
No. Okay. A really big hub that hired a lot of people. So my mother, who was frantic and in a panic by now, because she did not want me drafted because all the horror reports were coming out of Vietnam that it was just leading people to slaughter, and she didn't want me in that slaughter. So she went into a frantic pace of running around trying to find something for me to do. In the meantime, I'm running around drinking and smoking weed, you know, with the bad guys over at Castlemont High School in Oakland. So she came up with this brilliant idea to and went and scheduled me a testing date for the post office. So I went, took the test for the post office. I knew when I took that test that I had done an excellent job on that test. I knew it because I was totally comfortable with every answer that I put on that test. And so, and I told her that. And so she relaxed because she felt like, okay, well, I'll get hired by the post office, because they were hiring people right at graduation. You take the test before you graduate, you pass the test, they'll bring you to work as immediately after graduation, which would protect you from the draft. So June 16th came, I graduated, no response from the post office. Not even a, wow, you did great on the test, congratulations, and we'll schedule you an interview, because even that letter would get you a deferment until after the interview, before you were could be drafted. I didn't get that letter. So by June the 22nd, my mother had taken the liberty to go to a Air Force recruiter, sat down with this Air Force recruiter, and they made a deal. And he put it in writing that I would not go to Vietnam if I volunteered for the Air Force. I would enlist for 4 years. He guaranteed I would not go to Vietnam. And my friend, Curtis Johnson, they gave him the same guarantee, and they guaranteed my mother and his parents that they would keep us together. We both graduated at the same time. That they would keep us together as friends.
Is it like boot camp and the unit and everything?
Yes. Okay. So, well, actually after boot camp, because we got separated during boot camp. We went in at the same time. The whole time I was in boot camp, I never saw him. He was there, same time as me. We never saw each other. But our first base after boot camp was back to Sacramento. Well, after school. We went to school first and then back to Sacramento. I came to Mather in Sacramento, and they sent him there too. They actually sent him there. He got there a month before me because the school that they sent him to was shorter than the school that they sent me to.
So that they actually did what they said?
They actually did what they said. They sent us both to Sacramento. And we were very happy. You know, we became roommates, and we ran the streets of Sacramento together. And then all of a sudden, he gets orders to go to Vietnam. And so he left probably October of 67.
So it was a year in, would you say?
It was about a year in. He left and went to Vietnam in October. And my mother, who by then had been diagnosed with terminal cancer, she had a fit. She tried everything she could. She produced that letter. She tried to get somebody to read it. She tried to get somebody to pay any attention to it. She tried to get somebody to honor it. And nobody would do anything because, number one, I was still stationed in Sacramento, and there were no signs that I was going to go to Vietnam, except the obvious ones. Everybody was going.
Everybody left and right.
Everybody all around me was going. So I knew I'm going.
I knew it was coming.
I know I'm going. By December, I had my orders.
So it was like 2 months after?
Yeah, 2 months after he left, I had my orders to go to Vietnam and a different place than him. They were sending me over there to work on a different airplane than the one that they sent him over there to work on.
So you're a mechanic?
I was a flight mechanic, yes.
Okay.
And so we were totally separated and gonna be separated. So January, I had to report to Seattle, Washington to fly over to get to Vietnam. Well, the bad thing that happened is, and it was really, really, really bad, traumatic, and I'll never forget it. My flight was supposed to leave Seattle Monday morning. Well, Sunday was the Super Bowl, and my Raiders were in the Super Bowl. So that meant that I was gonna miss the Super Bowl, watching the Super Bowl on TV, because I would be traveling.
During that time
to get to Seattle. So I made a conscious decision to be late going to Vietnam. So I stayed at my parents and watched the Super Bowl Sunday. And then that Monday, I got a flight out of Oakland and went to Seattle to get my flight.
Did you try to make it?
To Vietnam. Yeah. No, I wasn't trying to make my regular scheduled flight. It was gone. So I went there hoping that they would get mad at me and send me back and tell me I didn't have to go, which was a pipe dream. There's no possibility of that. They got mad at me. That part came through. But they put me on the next flight that they had a seat. I sat in SeaTac, I think, for like 12 or 13 hours in all my gear and duffel bags and all that stuff, waiting for a flight that had room for me to go to Vietnam. So sitting in that airport, I got a sinus infection.
Just sitting there.
Sitting in that airport, I got a sinus infection. So they take me to the infirmary at the airport, the military part of SeaTac, and they diagnosed me and gave me some antibiotics and told me that next flight with a seat, I was going. So I finally got a flight and I went over. And by the time I got there, after 14, 15 hours on that plane, I think it's like 14 hours on that flight to Vietnam. By the time I got there, my head was packed solid, like a brick. It was solid. And I could barely breathe, and my headache was so bad, I thought I was gonna just pass out. And I get to Vietnam, and there's so much going on, and all these guns, and all these people, and all these scared people, and all these soldiers. I was in an absolute state of shock when I got there, and I got a pounding headache. And they marched us. It was so hot, you couldn't breathe. It was so hot. And they put us on a helicopter and flew us 150 miles or something to a base up in the Central Highlands called Pleiku. While I was on that helicopter, it packs your sinuses. Mine are already packed solid, and it just compressed it even more, you know, from the altitude and the pressure. It just packed it, and I thought my head was gonna split open, and there's bombs going off, there's rockets going off, there's all kinds of crazy stuff, you know, and I really just wanted to die. I didn't want to die a painful death. I wanted to just shut it off, just die and be out of that. But I get up there to that base and play cool, made it all right, got there, started unpacking. And when you get there, your bed doesn't have the mosquito nets. You have to install it. So I installed a mosquito net and started putting my stuff in my locker. And all of a sudden, there was the loudest boom I'd ever heard in my life. It felt like the whole building just jumped up in the air, like 5 or 6 feet up in the air. The bunk beds fell over, the locker fell over, and it was crazy. And I had not been there at that base for more than 2 hours.
And all that activity already
gone. All that happened within 2 hours of me getting to that base. What had happened was some snipers had infiltrated the base and blew up the bomb dock where they stored all the bombs and the munitions. They blew it up while I was unpacking. And I want to go home.
You know? Like, I'm already tired of this place.
I'm tired of this place. I want to go home. Oh, so anyway, that's the end of the high school era.
Here, let me stop this one. Okay. How was your transition from getting out of the military going into your civilian life?
Well, when I left Vietnam, I was so happy to be headed home. I went to the PX in Pleiku, and I bought brand new jungle fatigues. They were camouflaged. Brand new boots. Brand new brass for my belt. And I went and had the patches and the chevrons sewn on by a seamstress. I had my name stitched by a seamstress. It was beautiful work of art, you know, just poster soldier, because I survived and I'm on my way home. What could be better than that? So they put me on this airplane and I flew into Seattle. And depending on where you were gonna go next, where your flight was, determined what terminal you went to. So when I got to the terminal that I was on that was headed for a flight to San Francisco, there were protesters in the airport, Hare Krishnas and just a whole bunch of people. And they were rowdy, had signs, they threw fruits, they smashed eggs on me. I got hit in the eye with an egg that cracked after it hit me in the eye, hit my eye socket right on the outer edge of my eye socket, and that broke the egg. So I had egg yolk in my eye, I had pieces of shell in my eye, I had a knot on my head, and they were throwing fruits and calling us. There was like three guys with me. Well, they weren't with me, but they were all headed in the same direction. And I didn't know them. And they called me baby killers, a whole bunch of stuff. It was very, very, very bad. And the exact opposite of what I was feeling and what I thought I was coming home to. I thought I was coming home because I had been over there and nearly died on three different occasions, and to fight for this country. And then I came home and this country wants to fight me. And I'm really confused, you know, like, what the hell was I over there for, trying to stay alive, if it wasn't for you? And it was a very hard time. So that was the start of my bad transition back to normal life. So the first opportunity I had, I got out of the uniform. When I landed in San Francisco, you couldn't tell that I was military, because I had gone into my duffel bag in Seattle and taken off the messed up uniform that I had on and put on civilian clothes that were out of style. It was bad. It was ugly.
Okay, how long were you in Vietnam for?
I was in Vietnam a year.
A year, okay.
Yeah. So they didn't fit. They were out of style. It was crazy. Actually, what happened to me was, I didn't really start growing until after high school.
So you grew while you were in?
I grew while I was in. So my clothes were too short. My pants were too short. It was really bad. My shirts, the sleeves were too short. I looked horrible in the airport, and I had no confidence, no self-confidence at all. And I definitely didn't want to identify with military. So I immediately started being ashamed of the fact that I had just left Vietnam. And so my transition back to a normal life coming from Vietnam was horrible. It was really, 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 really bad. It was really hard. I was shell-shocked. When I left, I came to Oakland And I remember I didn't look up any friends. I didn't go find anybody. I didn't do anything. You know, I was there for a month, and then I had to go to my next assignment. My next assignment was in Washington, D.C. So I go to Washington, D.C., and it's a loud, violent place. That is hail.
Is it hail?
Sounds like
it. It looks like...
I think those are those leaves, but I think the hail is knocking them off the trees.
Okay.
So, car backfires, gunshots, all that kind of stuff just absolutely sent me into terrors. I couldn't sleep. I started staying up at night because that was how I lived in Vietnam. It was very difficult. The transition was, it took years. It took years.
And did you get help for that to help Tristan? No. It was just like...
No. The VA, yeah, that's a lot of help. The VA, at the time, did not recognize PTSD.
So it wasn't like a thing?
Unrecognized. I gotta go to the bathroom.
Oh, no. Was it difficult to find work after the military?
Actually, it wasn't. When I was discharged from the military, I left Washington, D.C., and I came back to Oakland. And when I got to Oakland, lots of companies were hiring military vets. If you had finished 4 years of military, oh my God, there were great jobs out there. So I took a job with a company called Thrifty Drugs as a manager trainee, and they paid me more money than I ever expected to make. They paid really, really, really good. No experience needed, and they put me on the job as a manager trainee and started training me in retail. And I stayed in retail for, let's see, that was in 1970. I retired from retail in 2017. Yeah.
There's that one. Is there anything else that you would like to discuss?
I just want to go back and touch on one little subject, and it's because it's one that's on my table right now. I got discharged, I left Vietnam in December of 1968. I came home and went through all the things that I went through trying to transition back to a normal life. In 1998, 30 years later, the VA said, you need to come in, we're going to examine you. The American Legion invited me to come in to be examined. So I came in, I went through a bunch of interviews, I went through a bunch of medical exams and a lot of tests and all kinds of crazy stuff. And they said, oh, you have PTSD, a very bad case of PTSD, and it's service-connected. I said, okay. And they said, so here, we're gonna compensate you for this. So by 1998 or 99, they finally approved it and gave me back pay to that date.
Since you got out of Vietnam, right?
No.
Or,
they gave me back pay to the day that the American Legion called me in and we submitted the application. So they paid me 1 year back pay. 1 year back pay, admitting that I had service-connected PTSD for 30 years already. 30 years I'd already had it, and it wasn't a recognized disease at the time. But they admitted that I had it and that it was caused by the war in Vietnam. And that's pretty much where I am today.
So just that 1 year they recognized
it? They paid 1 year back. And the